The following audio is from Midtown Fellowship in Columbia, South Carolina. If you're interested in becoming a part of our extended family, visit midtowncolumbia.com/partner.
Well, good morning again, friends. We have been teaching through Romans chapter 12 for the past 5 weeks, and today we're going to wrap this series up looking at our vision to be a Jesus-centered family on mission with Him. And so far in this series, we've talked about what it looks like to orient our whole lives around Jesus as living sacrifices. We've looked at how God calls us to belong to one another as family and participate in the body and serve. We've covered how we are a unified people under God, called to put Jesus on display to those around us in compelling and winsome ways. And our passage for today is going to catch us up on how to live as this kind of community for the long haul. So kind of what the stewards were talking about in the video. How do we do this over time, over the long haul? Because our identity as Jesus and your family on mission with Him is lived out over the course of our lives. So today we're going to look at the last few verses of Romans 12 and look at how we could get tripped up in the years and decades to come. So if you guys would, go ahead and open up to Romans 12. Verses 17 through 21. We're going to take a look at this passage again. And this wraps up Paul's train of thought in chapter 12. And he ends by saying this, "Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." And verse 21 really serves as a summary for this whole chapter, and especially for our content today. We're called to refuse to be overcome by evil and instead to overcome evil with good. Because the natural way of things in our fallen world is to be overcome by evil over time. So we're born into this world with bents toward evil and sin in our hearts. We're surrounded by other sinful people. And 1 Peter even tells us that we have a cosmic enemy that is pure evil and that he roams around like a lion seeking to devour us. So all the evil that is latent within ourselves and within those around us and in our culture and the spiritual realm we can't even see with our eyes is all pointed toward a trajectory of overcoming us. Evil works toward the disintegration of our very selves and our relationships. So as we go throughout our lives, things just fall apart. People fall apart. Relationships crumble and disintegrate. For you Stranger Things fans in the room, evil spreads like roots through the upside down, right under your feet, without us even knowing it. And this tendency to be overcome with evil is often hard to see on like a day-to-day or even week-to-week basis, but when you zoom out over time, it becomes really clear. And often those subtle ways are the most dangerous ways that evil can overcome us. So people change slowly over time in ways they don't even fully realize. Relationships drift apart, not because of anything huge, but just due to small things that serve as wedges. Maybe two people wake up one day after being married for decades, and suddenly they realize there is no foundation for their relationship anymore, and they don't know what happened. Things fall apart, and we become overwhelmed by evil and decay. And what Paul's saying here today is that Christians, we have the resources we need to refuse to be overcome by evil for the long haul. That we do not have to fall prey to the natural drift toward disintegration and decay of ourselves and our relationships. And even more importantly, he's saying that this trend of being overcome by evil in general also applies to the church. That the same forces of evil seeking to destroy people and relationships and marriages and families are also at work desperately to overcome the church. And the most extreme version I've ever witnessed of this happening happened when I was in high school. It was a church in my hometown that I was attending. It was the flagship Baptist church in our hometown. I was going to the youth group there. And one Sunday night, they had a business meeting about a disagreement that was occurring in the church. And to make a long story short, the pastor gets up on stage and starts addressing the disagreement that was happening. And the sound guy didn't like what he was saying. So the sound guy turned his volume off. just all the way off. And some people in the church did not like that at all. So a few of my friends, actually, who were not much older than me, went up into the balcony to confront the sound guy. And one of my friends almost threw the sound guy off of the balcony. And then the cops got called in and broke up the whole thing. It was awful. And that church split into three churches. The head pastor of that church went on to plant another church. And he ended up having an affair on his wife. And this all sickened me to such a degree that I almost gave up on church entirely. I almost just said, nah, I'm through with this. Obviously, I didn't since I'm up here today, but it was the most obvious example I had ever seen of a church being overcome by evil, where its members devoured one another instead of coming together in unity to display God to the world. But I want you guys to hear this. If things go south in our church, I don't think it'll go down like that. For one, we don't have a balcony to throw Micah off of, okay? So I think you're safe, Micah, don't worry. And two, we are fighting like crazy to have a healthier culture and healthier structures to keep things from going haywire like that. So if our church is overcome by evil, it'll be a lot more subtle. It'll happen over a long period of time. It won't be some big blow up, I don't think, but a culmination of 100 things that happen over years and decades that don't get resolved. It'll be because of small things that grow over time, like unresolved relational issues or bitterness or unforgiveness. It'll be because you get your feelings hurt by her and you never deal with it or seek to reconcile and you harbor a grudge that lasts over time. It'll be because someone sins against you and instead of confronting them in love and grace, you lash out against them. It'll be because you assume motives about other people in this room and judge them based off what you think to be true about them, based on your very limited understanding of their life. It'll be because division and drama take root in your life group, and instead of being squashed with the gospel, they are allowed to be permanent guests and decay relationships over time. And then all of a sudden, we're all 20 years older, and things are just not the same. Things are off, they're weird, and no one knows exactly what happened, but the light you feel amongst the people in this room will be dim, and the light that people outside of here see in our relationships will darken. And that's the most subtle and most likely way for a church to be overcome by evil. But family, we're not going to go down like that either, all right? We're not going to do that either. I would rather die than for us to become a group of distant, distrusting, gossiping, retaliating, grudge-holding Christians. So this morning, we're going to look at what Paul tells us to do to overcome evil in our midst for the long haul. And I've got two big things for us today. Two ways to overcome evil. And the first one is give grace instead of revenge. It's give grace instead of revenge. This comes directly from verse 17 where he says, "Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all." And the reason Paul has to say this is because our natural tendency is to repay evil for evil. It's the simple reality that hurt people hurt people. So if you hit me, I'll hit you back. If you insult me, I'll insult you back. If you get on my tail on the highway, I will aggressively tap my brakes while staring you down in the rearview mirror. And then I'll let you get ahead of me and I'll get on your tail. That was a little too specific, wasn't it? I think I just told it myself. This impulse to retaliate can take many different forms. Depending on your personality, it can be outward and obvious and aggressive, or it can be more like the covert cold shoulder, the silent treatment, the you're dead to me route. It can take a lot of different forms, but the hardwire reality is to retaliate. And this explains middle school cut-down fights, does it not? Some of you probably weren't very good at these cut-down fights. You were like, yeah, well, you're a dummy. But others of you were so creative and dark with your cut-downs that it even scared you at the time. You would cut someone down and it'd be like an atomic bomb just went off in the room. And people would start running around and screaming, oh, and it would just be this crazy scene. But Paul's telling us here that we are called to do the opposite of what comes natural to us. And so instead of repaying evil for evil, we're called to do what is honorable in the sight of all. And so for me, that brings up two really big questions. Why and how? Why should we do this and how should we do this? So those of you who've been around for a while know that part of the why is the story of the gospel, that we've been forgiven for more than we'll ever have to forgive. We've been vertically cleared of the most heinous sin and pride against God. And if that is our identity as Christians, that radically frees us up to pass that grace on to other people. We have grace just stored up in us that we can actually pass on to others. The gospel gives you a resource and a motivation to forgive that you did not previously have. But there's also a slightly different why that comes from our passage, and it actually shows up in verse 20, where he says this. He says, to the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head. There's some debate on exactly what is meant by that interesting phrase, in doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head. It certainly doesn't sound like a nice thing to do, does it? Doesn't sound like a nice thing to heap burning coals on your enemy's head. But we know from the context of this passage that Paul is telling us to bless those who persecute us, that the motivation for what he's saying is not animosity in the slightest. It's not bitterness or animosity. The best way I can explain what this verse is getting at is when someone hurts you and you get really angry and start to retaliate, what does your head feel like? It feels hot, right? That's where the term hot-headed comes from. It feels like your head is on fire. Like if you've ever seen a cartoon where steam is coming out of a character's ears, that means they're angry. And what this means is that retaliation is actually a way that evil spreads. So when you retaliate, it's a way that their evil is becoming your evil. It's spreading to you. You become inflamed and implicated in their evil. And things escalate just like they do in a middle school cut-down fight. So when someone harms you, it's like they are shoveling hot coals toward you. And when you choose to bless and forgive instead of retaliate, what you are doing is saying, no, thank you. I am not interested in your burning coals catching me on fire too. You can have them back. I'm not interested in participating in your evil. So the burning coals are passed back to them. And they can do what they want with them, but hopefully it'll break the cycle of evil and lead them to repentance. I saw a great picture of this recently. I was watching a video online about high school bullying. And this bullying expert was giving a talk to a school full of high schoolers. And he might as well have been preaching a sermon on this verse. Because what he did was he said that bullying is a game to get power over other people. And so he called up this high school girl up to the stage and he told her to give it her best shot to just ridicule and insult him and just drive him into the ground with her words. And so she started out by saying, you're an idiot. And he just was like, yeah. And he'd try to go back at her and she'd go something else. And at first he just played along. He tried to match insult for insult. And what he showed by doing this is that in participating in the game, she actually won. Because she passed her evil onto him in such a way that it inflamed him as he retaliated against her. And then he had her try the exact same thing again, the same way, and she started the same way by saying, you're an idiot. And he responded by saying, yeah, sometimes I do things that aren't very smart, but I've always thought you were really smart. And she just was like, what? And she was just so taken off guard by it. She kept trying to insult him, but with every jab, he responded with a diversion or by saying something nice about her. And it was so funny because after five or six of these things, after one of these compliments, she just stopped and she just said, thanks. And he ended it and he said, you see, I won. I won because I did not allow her evil to be passed on to me. And then lastly, our passage today also answers the question of how we're able to forgive. This answer comes in verse 19 where it says, beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. And Paul's actually talking here to people who would go on to experience dire persecution in their lives. Some would likely become martyrs, and many would know friends and families who would become martyrs. And he takes this solemn tone by calling them beloved. This is a very tender term, and it's also a term that God uses about Jesus. And in this, he is reminding them that instead of God repaying them for the evil they've committed, God forgives them and calls them beloved or dearly loved one. And then he says, never avenge yourself, but leave it to the wrath of God when someone harms you. And our wiring to retaliate is based off of justice and the idea that evil must be punished. And God in this verse says it will be. Every sin that's ever committed, from small things like white lies to big things like murder and abuse, will be paid for either by the person who commits them or by Jesus. Every act of evil will be paid for, so you don't have to retaliate. The pressure to make sure that evil is punished is not on you, and if you let that rest on you, it's going to ruin you. You aren't big enough to handle that weight. The writer Anne Lamott says that unforgiveness is like drinking rat poison and waiting on the rat to die. It'll eat you from the inside because you weren't designed to carry the weight of vengeance. So don't. Leave it to God, and he will do what he has promised. So church, the next time your spouse or roommate sins against you, the next time your life group member hurts you, the next time a person sitting in this room sins against you, repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. Don't avenge yourself. Instead, forgive them and bless them with the same grace you have received. Because as Christians, we're not called to simply respond in like kind to however someone treats us. Because any old sin-ruined person can do that. It does not take God's grace to respond in that way. We are called to respond to others the way Jesus responds to us. Number two, seek to live peaceably with all. Second way to overcome evil is seek to live peaceably with all. This comes from verse 18, which says, if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. This verse reminds us that a relationship takes two people. As Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock famously sang, it takes two to make a thing go right. It takes two to make it out of sight. Ultimately, you can't control the health or fate of a relationship, but you can do your part. And so after Paul gives this disclaimer that it takes two for a relationship, he tells us to do everything we can to live peaceably with all. And this gets tricky really fast because there are huge elements of living peaceably with others that do not come naturally to us at all. And so, for example, I want you to think about your body for a second. Maybe just look at your arms and your legs and your hands for a second. Think about your face. The reality is you have two permanent video cameras attached to your head. You have two ears to gather evidence about what the world and other people are like. And you have always and only exclusively experienced life through this embodied nature of your body. And if you are anything at all like me, this all leads you to think very logically that you must be an expert on life, right? You must be an expert on life. But the reality is you've only experienced life from an extremely limited point of view. You were likely born into a family that no one else in this room was born into. And that family had issues and weaknesses and generational sins in a mixture that is different than every other family represented in this room today. You've had experiences that no one else has had. You were called names in middle school that no one else was called. You've read articles online that have shaped the way you think that no one else has read in this room. And your unique experience in this world as viewed through your one and only body makes you develop beliefs about yourself, about other people, and about how the world works. You don't have to try to develop these beliefs. They will just automatically form. And they will be so self-evident and clear to you that the thought that someone else might not share them feels like it breaks your brain. It's just too much. You just can't handle it. And these beliefs become filters through which you see the world. And that means as you interact with other people and the world around you, you will primarily look for evidence that supports the beliefs you hold. So to stick with the theme, if you were bullied in middle school and you developed a belief that people don't really like you and they don't want to be your friend, and then you walked in here this morning and you saw someone across the room and you waved at them, but they didn't acknowledge you, you will say to yourself, see, I told you, self, people don't like me. They don't want to be my friend. Because beliefs become filters. Now, that person absolutely could have just been preoccupied. They could have had a really bad morning, and they could have not seen you. But because of your filter, that explanation won't rise to the top, will it? You'll say, see, told you. That's more evidence for what I already believe. In my job, I've often found myself in the role of conflict mediator, and I've never seen this played out more clearly than in conflict. Because what I've learned as a conflict mediator is that there really are two sides to every story. That's such a trite cliche that I hate, but it's really true. And I found myself in, you know, situations, for example, I'll be talking to a wife about what's going on in their marriage, and I'll come away thinking the husband is just a complete whiff. Just an awful, malicious person. And then later I'll talk to the husband and I'll be like, oh, wow. It's not that simple. It's not that black and white. And what's so interesting about these cases where two people just totally miss each other is that as a neutral observer, you can sit there and you can think, yeah, I can see why you think that, because you're viewing all of this through the lens of your past experience, and you're seeing all of these things as evidence for things you already believe. And then you can turn to the other side and you can say, and I can see why you think that, because you're doing the same thing. It's a very heartbreaking thing to watch. And there's just enough truth or reason on both sides to build a justifiable case, and both people are stuck, seemingly incapable of seeing the other side. And as into this messy human reality that Paul says, hey, do everything you can to live peaceably with those in your life. Do everything you can. And so in light of his command here, I want to give us three quick tips to live peaceably with those around you. And I do mean quick. So three quick tips here. Number one is realize that you have unique experiences and filters. Just realize that you have unique experiences and filters. Because we all tend to project our experiences and our filters onto others and onto our relationships. So I assume that other people think and operate just like me, and I project my expectations of myself onto them. Therefore, when people do things that I wouldn't do or let down my expectations, I view them like they are a defective version of me. They are just like me, except worse. But other people are not defective versions of yourself. They are people that have had unique experiences and have been shaped by their surroundings just like you have. If you ever get married, you will learn this one way or the other really fast. So, for example, my wife is my favorite person on the planet. If you know her, you know that I married way out of my league. If you do not believe in miracles, just come hang out with us for a while. Because she married me, and that is a miracle. And she is the warmest, most welcoming person that I know. Until I learned when we got married, until you get sick. Then she's not exactly the warmest person in the world. And this baffled me when I first got married, because I would get sick, and I would expect her to baby me just like my mom and grandma always did, right? For her to be like, oh, sugar, what do you need? What do you need, baby doll? And instead, she'd walk in the room and curtly pat me on the head and say, all right, hope you feel better. I'm going downstairs. And I'd be like, what is wrong with her? Why is she so mean, just suddenly? So at the time where I thought she would be even more warm and motherly than she already is, she turned into something else. And this confused me greatly because I was viewing her based on my experiences and my expectations. I was seeing her behavior through the filter of my life. But then when I learned more about her family, it made so much more sense, you guys. And in-laws, if you listen to this podcast, I love you so much, just to let you know. Love you so much. In my wife's family, sickness is weakness. And weakness is not to be tolerated. So when you're sick, the best thing you can do is act like you aren't. Tough it out. And if you can't tough it out, then we'll just leave you alone to spare you from the indignity of having weaknesses to your embarrassing display of weakness. We'll just leave you alone. I heard the story about how when Christy was a kid, she literally passed out one time. She passed out and crumpled on the floor. And her mom thought she was joking, so she kicked her and said, "Get up." And when I heard that story, I was like, everything makes sense now. Everything makes sense. I'm not mad anymore. I totally understand. Just don't kick me, yeah. This helped me to live peaceably with my wife because I realized she was not just intentionally being a jerk. She was different than me. She had a different upbringing than I did. She's not just a defective version of me. She's her own unique person. So everybody do me a quick favor. This is going to be a little different. I want you to do this, though, just for practice. I want you to turn to your neighbor and I want you to say, "You are not a defective version of me." Good job. Good job. Thank you. Now let's actually try to believe that and not just say it. It's a lot harder to believe. All right, second point, second tip is seek to understand. Second tip for living peaceably with others is seek to understand. So when someone reacts to a situation differently than you would, when they do something that you wouldn't, when they frustrate you or upset you, try to understand why they did what they did before you pronounce judgment on them. Ask questions like, "Why did you do that?" And "What made you respond that way?" And "What were you feeling when you said what you said?" And it may very well be that they sinned against you and that you need to confront them and forgive them. But it also may be something that makes a lot more sense when you understand what was going on in their mind. And true empathy and unity can be built if when something bothers or upsets you, instead of reinforcing and wallowing in your hurt, you instead go to the other person, withhold judgment, and say, "Hey, this kind of hurt me. Would you help me understand what you're thinking or feeling when you did this?" I brought up earlier that counseling a married couple through conflict and some of the tragic outcomes that can happen when both sides only see their version of the story. But what I've been struck by in those situations is that both sides, because of their different perspectives, perceive and feel hurt by things that were not intended to be hurtful by the other person. And too often, instead of examining that hurt and seeking to understand the other person, each side will just feed their hurt. Just feed it and wallow in it. And it'll grow bigger and bigger until you can't see anything but the hurt. And our culture might encourage us to feed our hurt and ask questions later. But Jesus frees us up to do the opposite. Jesus frees us up to ask questions before we ever think about feeding our hurt. And the irony is we could avoid a lot of unnecessary pain if we were willing to understand each other before jumping to conclusions. And some things that we perceive as hurtful are not actually hurtful if we are willing to do everything in our power to live peaceably with others. We'll seek to understand. And then last but certainly not least, assume the best, assume the best, assume the best. 3 exclamation points. Is that enough emphasis for you guys? Do we need more exclamation points? I thought about throwing my water bottle across the room and saying, "Assume the best." Oops, I did a little bit there. You guys, I've seen nothing more dangerous to relationships than a baseline posture of assuming the worst about others, where you look at circumstances and events, and instead of giving the benefit of the doubt, you look at that person or people and assume malicious intent. So something that very well could have just been a misunderstanding to be cleared up is perceived as a personal attack. something that could have had a different motive or explanation entirely, is assumed to be part of a covert war against you. And when you interpret everything through a negative lens, even someone's attempts at apologies or reconciliation are interpreted in a bitterly suspicious light. This is absolutely toxic to relationships. It's cancerous beyond description. And it's a perfect picture of evil overcoming good. So I want you guys to hear this morning. Please hear this. You are not an expert on the motives of other people. You're just not. You're not an expert on the motives of other people. We all think we are, but you're not. Take the most similar person to you in this room, and the inner workings of their mind might as well be a different universe. You don't know everything that's inside of someone's mind, and you don't know their motives. I don't care how well you know them. 1 Corinthians 13 paints a really beautiful picture of how the love of God will cause us to approach relationships that's actually the opposite of assuming the worst. I want you to hear this as I read this passage. It'll sound familiar to a lot of you. 1 Corinthians 13, 4 through 7. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. So notice it does not say that love is naive. It doesn't say that love lets people run all over you in unhealthy ways. But it does say that love is patient and kind. It says love is not irritable or resentful, meaning love doesn't hold grudges and view others in a negative light based on their past behavior. It says love does not rejoice at wrongdoing, which is exactly what assuming the worst does. Assuming the worst means that when others mess up, you say, I knew it. I knew you were going to do this. You relish that your prophecy about them came true and proved you right. But love is never glad when someone fails. It's never glad when someone fails. Verse 7 says, love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. I don't know of a more beautiful way to say that love assumes the best. Love is a posture of bearing and believing and hoping and enduring with others. It calls us to assume the best of one another. And even when they don't give us their best, we extend grace and bear with them. We practice patience and endurance instead of riding them off and assuming the worst. And this is entirely, utterly necessary for us to be a healthy church, you guys. And if we don't have a posture of trust and assuming the best, our relationships will disintegrate. And if we don't bear with and believe and hope and endure with one another, we are doomed. So can we all agree to make a concerted effort to assume the best? Can we do that? Let's try this again. Look to your neighbor and say, I will assume the best about you. All right, look to your other neighbor and say, you too. Please, let's work toward assuming the best out of one or from one another out of love. So as we wrap up today, I'm going to call the band back up here on stage, and we're going to spend a few minutes just reflecting on what we've talked about today and asking the Holy Spirit to examine our hearts and our relationships. First, I want to remind you that if we are actually faithfully being the church, then you're going to need all of the stuff we talked about today. Because the people in this room are going to hurt you, they're going to frustrate you, they're going to let you down, just like you will frustrate and let them down. So as my friend Adam says, a church that doesn't have relationship problems is just a church that doesn't know each other. A church that doesn't have relationship problems is a church that doesn't know each other. So if we have relationship issues and tension and frustrations and weirdness, that's actually a good thing in a way because it means we're actually becoming a family. And our passage today gives us a blueprint for how to deal with these things in a healthy and biblical way and refuse to be overcome with evil. And the good news for all of us is that God has promised to overcome evil in the end. And that's what he's already doing here and now. And we just get to join him by following him in these things. So if any of this struck a chord with you today, I want you to commit to having the necessary conversations with those people this week. And if something's pressing on you and you have tension with someone in the room, I'd love for you to go grab them and talk with them today before we take communion at the end. And even if things are just a little weird with you and someone else and you don't even know why, man, I'd love for you to grab them and have a conversation and just say, hey, I don't even know what happened really, but things just feel a little weird. So I want to make sure our relationship does not get overcome by evil. So I wanted to talk to you today. If you need to step out, make a quick phone call, do that. But as we conclude, think and pray about these questions up here on the board. Who do you want to lash out at or repay evil with evil? Do you have anyone you need to forgive? Who do you have relational conflict, tension, or weirdness with? Who can you just not seem to get along with? Are you assuming the worst about anyone in your life right now? And then lastly, what conversations do you need to have? For that last one, I'd encourage you to go ahead and write down any names or next steps that you might need to take. And if you need to, for accountability, maybe even go ahead and send a few texts to set up a meeting or a phone call before you chicken out of doing that. But let's take all this seriously. Let's go to the Lord and ask him to look at our hearts and look at our motives and our relationships. Let's spend some time in silence praying through these questions. In a few minutes, we'll pray and wrap up and take communion together. Father, I thank you that you have not repaid me evil for evil, for the wrath that I deserve from you. I thank you that you have not repaid us evil for our evil against you, but that you have given us grace instead. You've reconciled us to yourself through the costly blood of your son, Jesus. You've adopted us into your family, that you love us and redeem us. And so please help us to be able to do the same for others, and to not repay evil for evil when we are hurt by others inside of this church family or outside. Pray that you would give us grace instead of revenge and retaliation. I pray that you would give us the resources that we need to live peaceably with everyone in our lives as much as it depends on us, and to not assume the worst about people, to seek to understand them, to realize that people are different than us, and that everything is not a covert war against us. And so pray that you give us the grace and the security that we need to approach relationships in a healthy and biblical way, and to find our security and our identity in you, so that we can approach these relationships in a way where they don't have to devastate us. And so please give us the resources we need. We thank you that it's through your son's blood that we can approach you, that we can be forgiven by you, and that we can know you. We love you. Amen.